I'm going to address the 19th century elements of the project, and then I'll hand over to Victoria, who will talk about the Zooniverse side, citizen science in the 21st century. So apologies to those who have heard something about the project, but for those who haven't, I feel like I need to fill in a bit of the background. So it's a project that is focused in the 19th century on the science periodical. It arose, Gavin Dawson and I, who was a co-investigator in Leicester, had done a previous project, SciPer, Science in the 19th Century Periodical, which had looked at the science content in the general periodical. So looking at the way science might emerge in the fiction, the political reporting, to get some sense of the modes of penetration and the interaction between science and the culture. But we were always aware that what we'd like to do and had not touched in that project were the literal, I think, acres, miles of science periodicals published in the 19th century. And we chose the 19th century because that is the time of absolute explosion of the science periodical. So I think we make a wonderful companion piece to Cultures of Knowledge, because you're looking really at the origins of the science periodical. We are looking at the period when it really takes off, because you have perhaps 100 periodicals that could be labelled as scientific at the beginning of the 19th century, and by the end you have 10,000. Just extraordinary explosion. And what we're interested in is looking at all these periodicals that no one looks at now. Even historians of science, you get the main names occasionally, and I think that things might alter now as things are digitized. People are going to put in searches and come across periodicals that they've never heard of, and follow a little snippet like that. But nobody has actually really addressed in depth the large-scale science periodical publishing. And what we're interested in, particularly, is the role of the citizen within this. Now, we were aware we're using a very anachronistic term, but that is in part sort of provocative, and we're hoping to show the ways in which thinking about what happened in the 19th century can help us with the 21st century. I freely admit that when we were originally putting together this project, I'd not thought of linking it to the 21st century, but the HRC said you had to, for this particular call, which is in science and culture, you had to work with contemporary scientists. And that put me in mind of Zooniverse and the work being done by this, as Victoria will tell us, very large citizen science project, which enables people in the comfort of their own homes to actually participate in contemporary science projects. And I realised there was really strong parallels between what was happening there and what was happening in the 19th century, with all the periodicals being set up, with the natural history societies, the mechanics institutes, the meteorological explorations, where ordinary citizens were being asked to participate and were creating their own journals in order to publish the proceedings of their little societies. And so what you get in the 19th century is a huge spreading across of scientific activity linked to periodical publishing. And what we're really interested in is that interface between the growth of scientific activity and the modes of publication, and the ways in which lots of commercial journals were set up, because we tend to think of commercial journals as more something of the 20th and 21st century. But you get a lot of them in the 19th century, and you can see the ways in which they set off grandly with sort of virtually everything under the sun in their title, and then that gets whittled down and they become more focused, then they go bust, and then they try another move, and so it goes on. And if you've ever tried to follow a periodical in the Bodleian catalogues, you will find that they might change their name sort of 10 times quite readily in the 19th century. Some of them survived, others were just for a few years. But extraordinary richness. And when I went to see Chris Lintott to discuss whether it might be possible to think of teaming up, it was wonderful to discover that actually this was something that was almost a godsend for him, because he'd been working with teams of citizen scientists, some of whom had come, who had actually then gone on to educate themselves to quite high levels. Some had made amazing discoveries in astronomy and were having internal discussions on the web forum, but were not being picked up or linked with the professional science community. And so what we bring from the 19th century is an exploration of science before you get you got solid professionalisation. Now, a history of science has tended to treat the 19th century as the period in which you have professionalisation. But it is far more complex than that. If you follow through, you see that there are no real divisions. You do get the emergence, yes, of the professional scientist, but the divisions between the professional and the amateur are very, very blurred in all sorts of different ways. And indeed, one of the problems or really sort of challenges for our project is coming up with the right language. Because professional and amateur just doesn't work really in the 19th century, and I assume that it's the same for the cultural knowledge. Similarly, lay and professional, again, it's somewhat anachronistic. So we're trying out all sorts of different languages, and we'd be quite interested to hear what happens in the cultures of knowledge. Another angle of this work is also looking at what we see as the point of explosion of the science periodical in the 19th century and the potential demise of the printed copy. What happens to the science periodical when it's no longer a solid material entity? You have publication continuously online. This is the Royal Society, I noted the other year, sort of announced that they were more or less going to abandon hard copy publication in the future. But they rushed to reassure their participant observer contributors that they were going to have a cover still. Why do they need a cover if they're actually publishing sort of continuously? But also it raises the question of what's the interrelation of the contents? Are they just completely independent? Because we've grown used to the notion of publishing that is interactive across the volume. And so we are raising all sorts of questions about readerships as well. And the potentiality of opening up science to wider readerships. And one element that gave us real inspiration for the project was a paper published by the Royal Society, I think it was 2010 or 11, in Biology Letters, Black Autumn Bees, which was, you might have, it got quite a lot of publicity at the time, but it was actually part conceived, carried out and written by primary school children. Quite wonderfully, they were looking at the patterns that bees have in going to various flowers and how they pollinate. We'll use the pollination for the flowers. Apparently, actually produced really new data. But very sadly, this has not been followed through. We thought this might be opening up. You know, suddenly you'd see science being opened up to all sorts of new audiences and publication, but it's not happened yet. But citizen science, I think Victoria will suggest, does open real possibilities. Indeed, then helps us also think about what was happening in the 19th century as well. Now, forms of journal publishing in the 19th century also had lots of modes of exchange. And now, the problems for the Zooniverse team were how do you create those modes of exchange between the amateurs and the highly professionalised scientific body, who normally don't speak to each other outside, even they can be in the same department, and they don't speak across the labs because they're so specialised. And so it's quite a challenge, but we do think that the Zooniverse is helping open up all that. And so we have very grandiose plans of transforming modes of science education in schools, popular understandings of science, and also, hopefully, professional scientific practice. But that is hugely, hugely ambitious, as you will realise. Now, another one of our inspirations is necessarily Darwin. When he was developing his theories for the origin of species, he corresponded with virtually 2,000 different people. And here again, I think it links up to your ideas about networks of correspondence for the cultures of knowledge. So what I see Darwin doing is virtually running his own highly labour-intensive citizen science project. Because he wasn't just corresponding with eminent gentlemen of science, he was corresponding with pigeon fanciers, cattle breeders, etc. If you've read The Origin, you'll sort of realise that the whole, it is a narrative. I see it almost like a Victorian novel, because you've got so many casts of characters. You know, there's the Hereford cattle breeder saying, oh no, well that's it, I didn't do it. So he's drawing on all the people he's been corresponding with and putting together this wonderful story that then transforms science itself. Now, with his canonisation then as a man of grand science, it's easy to forget that his own roots were in this strong amateur tradition. And I'd like to just take you through a bit of the places he chose to publish, because I think they're rather telling. So his first publication was 1836, and it was a letter with Fitzroy in the South African Christian Recorder. And then you see him as he's... moves up the scale, you have publications and the proceedings of the Geological Society, the Zoological Society, and the Entomological Society. But then suddenly you get the Annals of Natural History, which are not quite up there with those societies. And then in 1839, for example, he publishes first in the Phil Trans, but then he immediately follows it by a publication in the Penny magazine of the Society for the Diffusion of Useful Knowledge in 1840. So you've got this movement back and forth between what you call the high-level science periodical and magazines absolutely designed for a popular audience. Other examples, in 1841, he publishes on humblebees in the Gardener's Chronicle. And I'll be picking up on the Gardener's Chronicle because he continues to publish in this occasionally for the rest of his career. And even after the publication of The Origin, you find him publishing in The Cottage Gardener and Country Gentleman in 1860, or The Field, or Hardwick's Science Gossip, which is a favourite of the project. I should say that our logo, the CSC, are taken from Science Gossip. But he also, interestingly for our purposes, uses these journals to ask for information from contributors. Thus, in 1857, he publishes in the Gardener's Chronicle, and it's an article on mouse-coloured breed of ponies, and he uses the article to ask for the readers for any information that they have. Or similarly, in 1866, he publishes an article on the feet of otterhounds in a magazine for country gentlemen called Land and Water. And again, he's appealing for information for those who keep otterhounds. So you can see that he has to target all of his appeals of information according. So he's very precisely chosen Land and Water, because that's where otterhound owners might choose to browse on Saturday afternoon. So in creating then his theories on the origin of species, he was absolutely dependent on the expertise of cattle breeders, pigeon fanciers, etc., and amateur naturalists. Now, as I've suggested, from the 1830s, you then have this explosion of periodicals, partly linked to things like the Society for the Diffusion of Useful Knowledge, instigated by Lord Brougham from 1826, or the foundings of mechanics institutes, but also the creation of naturalist clubs and the founding of natural history societies and field clubs. And now these are very interesting to pursue. Some of them are definitely the gentry. Others, as Anne Secord has shown, are quite working class in base, and some interesting mixtures. And a lot of them publish their own journals. So just to draw, for example, on the first volume of the Wiltshire Archaeological and Natural History magazine, which followed the Berwick Naturalist Club in the 1830s. And the opening address of Foundeer draws on John Herschel's Discourse on the Study of Natural Philosophy, where he argues for the infinite advantages of the local observer. He concludes, "And it's to the increased number of such local cultivators of science enjoying these peculiar opportunities that he ascribes the immense progress made of late years in the physical sciences, a
progress which in its advance cannot but entail, as Herschel goes to remark, incalculable benefits upon mankind. So all these societies were drawing strong comfort from the notion, or inspiration, from the notion that they were the ones that had the knowledge of the local diversity of species. And interesting to note that the records of species diversity are still in amateur hands. And I hadn't really appreciated this until we started the project. So we're working, we have three partners, we're working with Leicester University, but then in London we've got the Natural History Museum, the Royal Society and the Royal College of Surgeons. But this is the Angela Marmon Centre at the Natural History Museum, which works with amateur naturalist communities. And we're actually, and I think Victoria might say a bit about the experiment we're going to do with amateur naturalist communities. But just to show you, you have all these amateur societies which are now still in charge of recording the diversity. And so, for example, on the National Biodiversity Network, you've got submitter sighting. And if you follow these things through, you find that people dotted all over the UK in their living rooms are the base for recording individual species. So it's a wonderful area. Another area was meteorology. Here you've got a magnificent amateur base. There was a very good book on this by Catherine Anderson, Predicting the Weather, where she drew a contrast between James Glacier, who worked at Greenwich and had just 50 trained observers, versus George James Simmons, who created the British Rainfall Organisation, which he built up gradually from the 1860s through to 1900, so that by the end he had 3,400 stations across the UK. He used the Times to appeal for observers, saying we still haven't got anybody in the Outer Hebrides, and telling the readers that they don't need to have any equipment, and if they can't, beyond a mere rain gauge, and if they haven't got one, he'll send them one, and suggests that all ages and all classes and both sexes can participate. I just want to give you his wonderful. This is it from, he published the British Rainfall Survey, and this is his statement in 1880, where he says, this is his preface, I am myself sometimes astonished at the magnitude of this amateur organisation, without either state aid, malevolent title, managing council, or pecuniary resources, except the voluntary contributions of the staff, a staff whereof the members rarely see one another, and still more rarely see their chief, who resides in all parts of the country, who include nearly every social grade from peer to peasant, and yet, with exceptions so rare they take me by surprise, work with a regularity and heartiness which is beyond praise. Why do they do it? Minor motives may have so influence, but I believe that the leading sentiment which binds together British rainfall observers is the consciousness that they're helping gradually to store up a mass of information which is and will yearly become increasingly valuable to the nation at large in relation alike to agriculture, sanitation, and the proper appropriation of the water supply of the British Isles. So this vision of all his observers being motivated by the fact that they're going to add to the scientific findings of the country and improve the lot of their fellow men. Another huge area of amateur participation was public health. We have Sally Frampton with us, who's working in this area on public health and more generally the medical periodical. And I have to say we also have Grace Chumley here, who's working on a range of areas within the project, but in part also on agriculture and natural history. So, skip through a bit. I thought I might give you just an example now of one of the...
This is Benjamin Ward Richardson, who a Punch cartoon, but he was one of the leaders of the public health movement. And then I thought I'd put this in, because this is the Meteorological Office, who are still encouraging citizen science, a bit like Blue Peter, but you too can put together your barometer and measure rainfall. I was just going to give you now an example. This is the proceedings, the Dorset Natural History and Antiquarian Field Club. I think it's 1790s, but just to show, I don't know if you can read that, but just to show one of the examples of how extraordinarily sort of eclectic some of the contributions can be. So you've got descriptions of species of Lepidoptera, and then you probably can't read it, but I chose this one. The Summa Romano, British relics found at Maxgate, Dorchester, by Mr. Thomas Hardy. But then you go through and you've got a report on the rainfall and observations of flowering plants, etc. Just to show that some of them could be absolutely beautifully illustrated. So this is a Lepidoptera from that.
Now I want to just to move on to talk finally about absolute stellar citizen scientist we've just started working on. It's Eleanor Ormerod, who was of 1828 to 1901. Now she was born to a wealthy landowner. And she was educated by her highly intelligent mother and father at home, but she had a fairly imprisoning father who was not so keen when she started to be very interested in insects, and so she had to keep her interests to herself to some degree. But then, in 1868, age 40, she was browsing the Gardener's Chronicle and saw a request from the Royal Horticultural Society to send specimens. She did this for the next 10 years, organised. So I think this is a two-layered citizen science, because she managed to do this by organising all the labourers and the children on the estate. And they were given a shilling if they came up with a new specimen for her. So using her position, she managed to create an extraordinary collection of insects. And on the death of her father in 1873, she suddenly springs into life. So in that year, she publishes in the Gardener's Chronicle, in the Journal of the Entomological Society, and also in the Journal of the Linnaean Society. So she really hits all the buttons. She was given a medal by the Royal Horticultural Society, but also she was a meteorologist. And one of the things we're finding in this work is the ways in which people were distinguished in both areas, in multiple areas. So Simmons, for example, has only been written about with reference to meteorology, but actually he also was hugely important in public health. You saw at the end he was interested in rainfall, the provision of water. So you can areas that have been distinguished by historians, if you follow through the patterns in the publications of the time, actually start to be all interconnected. So Eleanor Ormerod became an absolute international expert. From 1877, she published annual reports of observations of injurious insects, and she became the consulting entomologist of the Royal Agricultural Society, but not officially employed. And things came to a bit of a sticky end when they appointed a male in her stead. And you find that she enters into correspondence with people across the globe. So the US Department of Agriculture, for example, is asking her advice, as are many other countries, because although she scarcely ever left her estate, she actually became the expert on all sorts of international insects as well. So she, I offer her as a model for us now to think of. You know, she was obviously well born and well connected, but she functioned in a way that through networks and through publications that enabled her to rise up from an undistinguished female position to an international authority. But I'll hand over now to Victoria, who's going to talk about 21st century citizen science.
So, a bit of a paper in two parts, and thank you, Sally, for kicking us off with the 19th, sort of 20th century aspects. Many of you are probably already familiar with Zooniverse projects, but I'll just give a brief history. The Zooniverse began with a single project called Galaxy Zoo, which was launched in July of 2007 by Dr. Chris Lintott, who's now a professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of Oxford, and Dr. Kevin Chwinski, who was a graduate student at the time. And Kevin had a difficult task, which was 900,000 images from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey needed classification in order for him to start saying anything meaningful about the galaxies that had been captured by the project. He needed to separate them into two kinds, the spiral type that you see here and the flat or disk shape. And he did about 50,000 in a week and quickly realized that this was just too big a task. Data was coming in on an unprecedented scale. Most people didn't have to deal with this level of data deluge before. And so he and Chris hatched a plan. What if they could make an online interface and ask people to do this basic classification task and have an opportunity to contribute to real science? And the goal from the beginning was to signal that this is a real scientific project and to invite people to engage. And the project was successful. The crowd got through the available data in a matter of weeks and months. And what was great about it was that because multiple people were classifying each image, the data that came out of the project was actually quite good. So, you know, instead of tired Kevin on the 48,000th galaxy misclassifying and sort of losing the plot, you had 38 people doing each task. And this, in turn, renders really good machine learning data sets as well. Zooniverse then went on. It was properly founded in 2009 at the University of Oxford and also has a wing or a branch at the Adler Planetarium in Chicago, and over 400 academic partners all around the world. We've also branched out into more areas, which you've probably gathered from Sally's talk. Biology, astrophysics, of course, climate science, and the humanities, which is a humanities person I'm particularly interested in. We have some projects in the fields of music, papyrology, and history of World War I, which I'll mention in a little bit. In the context of the CONSCICOM grant, we're preparing to build new projects that explore the resonances between the 19th and 21st centuries, and which also enable us to explore new kinds of functionality, new ways of building communities, as Sally already mentioned, and new ways of allowing people to play with the data that they themselves are generating in the course of these projects. I don't think I need to say this, but I just am going to put it here for a moment. And allow people to maybe make a note of the Newman et al. Paper, The Future of Citizen Science, Emerging Technologies and Shifting Paradigms. I think this is quite a useful definition that I come back to. It's also quite good for what I call academic crowdsourcing generally. Throughout this talk, I just want to scatter through a few principles that have emerged that the Zooniverse team talk about whenever we're sitting down to plan a new project. Amongst ourselves and with our project partners to be. Tasks really need to strike a balance between being sufficiently complex in order to capture meaningful data, but they also need to be straightforward enough and engaging enough, and indeed the user interface needs to be nice looking enough to get people interested and hooked on the project. And speaking of addiction, this is probably one of our most addictive projects, Snapshot Serengeti. Users go through data that's been gathered by a web of camera traps in the Serengeti, and they do have to do a slightly complex task or a layered task. They identify what kinds of animals are in each image, how many of them there are, what they're doing, and the data has not only shed some new light in terms of how big cats in the Serengeti get along with smaller cats, so lions, how they get on with cheetahs and hyenas. But it's also, I gathered today from our lead scientist on this project, that the their use of camera traps, the methodology itself, has been proven to be quite a valuable way forward, and apparently this has been disputed in her area of research, which I thought was interesting. We work in a variety of media. Not all projects are image-based. Some of them are audio-based. This is Whale FM. We also have Bat Detective. In addition to audio, we have video. This is Wormwatch Lab, which has recently gotten a bit of a makeover, so you can use it on your mobile phone and other devices in case you fancy watching worms in public. This is Notes from Nature, which is a sort of what I like to think of as an interdisciplinary project, and we have a few that would fall into that camp, I think. So there are various bug, bird, and other specimens, but the task is asking for people to transcribe the labels and to use a sort of drop-down list to give geolocation information. And those are just some statistics about when the project was launched and the number of classifications and so on. This is Operation War Diary, which launched in January of this year. I've been a little bit involved with it, so I'm quite attached to it, I guess. And it's quite a timely project, of course. Users have to transcribe World War I field diaries. British infantry units would keep records of their activities, their troop movement, the way they spent their time, casualties, losses, and so on. And it goes from the period 1914 to 1918. And then here are some of the wow numbers, the big numbers. What I'm particularly interested in is that 61,000 pages have now been completed and that they've been tagged and transcribed by 7 people. And this is the, I'm sorry, this isn't terribly clear, but the white tags show the drop-down menu tags that people have used to say there's troop movement, there's a withdrawal, there's been a death, and then the dates and times are going down on the left-hand side. And then in brackets, you get numbers saying how many people who saw this page said that this thing, this feature was there. So you also get a sense of the consensus. This is an in-house consensus engine called WD3, which was made by my colleagues Jim O'Donnell, who created Operation War Diaries Interface, and Rob Simpson, who sort of does a bit of everything. This is on the menu for ComSciComm, but there are more things to come. Illustrated Life, which I'll show you in a moment, is already underway. Jim O'Donnell, again, who made Operation War Diaries, is working on this project. And it's a partnership with the Bioheritage Library in Missouri. And if you want to read a bit more about that project and the BHL's other activities and engagement with crowdsourcing, please go check out that link. And Industry and Illness is a partnership with the Wellcome Trust Library, and Sally Frampton is going to be using the data that comes out of this. The important thing for both of these projects is that postdocs who are on the ComSciComm grant feel that they can use the data and be part of the research community and the community that's engaging with the volunteers once it gets going. And this is an image, a screenshot from the project. It may not look like this, but we thought, you know, it's nice to see a demo. Sally touched on this before, and I think I find myself echoing Simmons, who was quoted earlier, about sort of the reasons that people seem to be participating and why it's exciting and interesting. From the Zooniverse perspective, and in contrast to Eleanor Foreman, who we heard about, money and prizes are not involved, I'm sorry to say. I'm quite glad to say, actually. And we don't particularly gamify projects. And this came up last week, two weeks ago, in Catherine Eccles' wonderful talk in the same series. And she talked about gamification and incentivization of users in multiple directions. And some of the conversation that emerged at the end of that talk is that narrative is a powerful tool, and I'd like to sort of suggest that narrative is something we can use more, but sort of very gamey gamification we're probably not going to be pursuing. This is a paper, I Want to Be a Captain, I Want to Be a Captain, which is produced by one of our developers in Chicago, Stuart Lin, and a group whose names are all on the top there. And they discuss the outcome of an experiment in which a small degree of gamification was introduced to this project, Old Weather, and users were given the opportunity to go from cadet to captain of a particular ship. And that move was based on how much transcription they had done, not how well they had done it. And then this was the conclusion of that paper, which I'll leave up there for a moment and have some water. The things that stand out for me from this is that how do you strike the middle ground between encouraging people to stay, challenging sort of the super users, the people who are really going to put in the time, giving them an extra layer of engagement without it seeming to trivialize the data collection and also without driving people away if they don't feel competitive. This is another slide that I really like because it shows how user motivation correlates with clear signaling about what you are doing this project for. This is from the Milky Way project, which again is one of Rob Simpson's analytics and also something that he works on. This shows the point at which it was announced that the data that was available had been classified to the degree that was required, and further classification was not necessary for the science team, but people were welcome to continue to interact with the project if they wanted to. But if they wanted to spend their time elsewhere on this universe, they'd be very welcome to do so, and it seems that they did. I'd like to see what happened, you know, was there a spike in other projects, but analytics for another day. And the major principle that we get from that is that volunteers are eager to participate in real research and data processing, and that contributing to knowledge is an end in itself. And I think I'm just very much echoing Sally's paper when I say that. Further principles about sort of user interface and volunteer motivation, I take it from Ancient Lives, which asks users to transcribe Greek papyri. But the good news is you don't need a background in ancient Greek to be able to do this because you have a lovely keyboard and some sample images. So if you mouse over, you get to see the specific examples of what you might be looking at and then sort of click away. And then the editors who receive the information on the other end can edit in a sort of bespoke editing tool. The principle that comes out of this is that a successful UI user interface allows non-specialists to participate, but a great user interface allows them to learn and acquire new skills, and I sincerely hope that the ConSciComm projects that we're doing will really move into that area more to think about how do we get users speaking to one another more, how do we get them perhaps to publish using either in-house tools or other resources, and to work collaboratively with science teams, which the universe has a fairly good track record of doing already, but it'd be nice to do more of it and encourage more of that. In the last few minutes, I'm going to go slightly off-piste and talk a bit about my own work, because I think some of the challenges that are being faced in full-text manuscript transcription, which we're doing with Tate Britain, apply and raise some principles that may be tackled in the ConSciComm grant as well. The goal of this project is to democratize access to a collection of manuscripts and archives at Tate Britain. They're already digitized, they're already online, but the goal is to get people to be able to read 20th century handwriting and to be able to produce word-searchable transcriptions of manuscripts. These will then go into the library catalog. They'll be well indexed so that they can be actually found. It's not enough to transcribe something and throw it onto the internet, as many of you in this room already know. It needs to be marked up in a way so that it's machine readable. And my personal goal, to put at the bottom, is to create a new workflow for crowdsourced transcription. We've heard a bit about crowdsourced transcription earlier in this series. I was very sorry to miss Melissa Terrace's talk about Transcribe Bentham and some of the challenges. We are facing the same challenges of how you motivate a community and keep people going with transcription. One of the ways we want to do this is by making the task maybe a bit simpler. This is a sample image from the Tate project. Users will go through and identify the non-text features. They'll just say image, sketch, watercolor, what have you. And then they'll drop points. You can see I've just put two asterisks at the top line. And then they'll have a box into which they can transcribe and or something along those lines. We've actually just hired our developer, so he'll be figuring this out soon. And we'll ask end users, maybe five, maybe seven, to transcribe each line. These will be compared automatically using a string matrix algorithm and then retired if a consensus is found. If it isn't, the lines will then be shown to two editors who then, their answers will be compared and hopefully agreement will be found. And it may get to the point where if that's not working, we just need to have a human editor intervene, but we're trying to minimize that because that's a huge time sink. As I was alluding to, granularization is what we're focusing on. A lot of Zooniverse projects already do this, and we think that by giving people tasks that can be done within a relatively short space of time, that hooks them in a bit better. Catherine also mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. It kind of gives you this little energy, this little hit when you've done something and you've completed it. So we want to make the tasks and the projects more accessible, ask less time per classification of each user, and hopefully then mitigate against user fatigue and minimize the repetition of tasks in the long run. Sally mentioned that I might be making a brief mention of an ORCIDS project, is what I'm assuming you meant, and I will talk about that briefly, but I'm freestyling now, so bear with me. The NHM in London has a very compelling idea, which is to combine online citizen science classification and data reduction with people going out into the field and taking pictures. There are already citizen science projects out there that do this. There's something in Delaware and along the eastern seaboard where people go out into the moonlight and have an app on their phone and take pictures of horseshoe crabs because they're a really fascinating and endangered species and it involves dancing in the moonlight, so what could go wrong? This project will tap into really robust communities in England who already have an attachment to orchids and into wildlife in England more generally. And I think it's probably very much a series of communities that is pretty much descended from this 19th century group. So they'll be photographing orchids, and those will then feed in, and they'll be classified by a sort of worldwide group of citizen scientists. If you want to stay tuned, please visit consicom.org, and if you want to classify, zooniverse.org is the place for you. Thanks a lot.